confirm we have a recording?
Jonathan, the recording has been started.
Okay, great. So I'll kick off then to welcome everyone on behalf of myself and Lisa, your co-chairs. Yes, happy Thanksgiving indeed to our American colleagues and those that are celebrating Thanksgiving around the world. The purpose, first of all, is obviously we'd like to do a welcome to you and the roll call. As you heard perhaps a moment ago, I suggested that we take the roll call as read insofar as members and participants are in the Adobe Connect room. It would be helpful if anyone who is not in the Connect room but on audio and wishes to record themselves as present make themselves known now, please.
It's Greg Shatton. I'm getting into the Adobe Connect room, but I'm not there yet.
Thanks, Greg. All right, Natalie, I suggest we take a log of who is on the in the Adobe Connect room now and at the end of the call, and that will be a useful basis on which to know who has been present. Beyond the welcome and roll call, we wanted to just make a couple of comments on the and the sort of review and opportunity to make any for anyone else to make any comments on the Frankfurt meeting. Obviously, it took place over 2 days last week, Wednesday and Thursday, 19th and 20th of November, there were 2 full days, including an unscheduled additional session into the evening on Wednesday, the 19th. I understand clearly it wasn't convenient for everyone to be there, but those that were unable to participate were generally able to secure an alternate and or participate to a lesser or greater extent remotely. So there was pretty good representation, and there was additional attendance not only by members who were in effect sponsored to attend by ICANN, but also a reasonable number of participants managed to attend in person, around 12, I believe, and we had overall around 40 participants, and you may have seen Grace's note which to the group, which indicated that that's some sort of average attendance per regular meeting, notwithstanding any issues like Thanksgiving. There's no doubt in my mind it was very useful, if not vital, to meet face-to-face, and I think we achieved a substantial amount in going through that. We certainly, you know, we worked systematically through the principles, the review of items 1, 2, 2A and 2B as sort of derived from the RFP, the ICG RFP, and clearly the substance of the meeting then, as it will be today, and it was RFP 3. As you will know, going into the meeting, we had that substantial straw man document which looked at multiple parallel scenarios and attempted to parse them out in that way. And whilst that was and remains a useful device to cross-compare the different segments, we found it difficult to make significant forward-moving progress, or at least at the pace that was, you know, is required of us based on what we need to do. And so we sort of tackled it in a, we then reverted to or modified our approach to tackle in a slightly different way, and those of you that were there or participating remotely will know that. And so we really just, we took the structure and questions of the RFP 3 as it arrived from the ICG and began to work through it that way. And that helped us make much more rapid progress. And out of that, we managed to generate a structure and framework for the response to RFP 3, and ultimately committed to the production of the document, which you have now seen in its initial draft form. And I know, again, there hasn't been a lot of time to look at that overnight and this morning, depending on which time zone you're in. But nevertheless, that document is there for us to see, and clearly, immediately after the meeting, we had the chair's statement, and we've had some quite substantial, exchanges online in the interim. So I think that's, you know, I don't think we want to dominate this meeting with a review of the Frankfurt meeting. Clearly, the crux of this meeting is to try and make some decent comment under Section 4 of the agenda on the document as it now stands and try and really make help to keep moving that forward. We've clearly got a good platform on which to build coming out of Frankfurt, but now need to continue to do that building. So let me pause here and call for any comments or questions or points relating to Frankfurt before we move on to item 3 and get the next component of the agenda. All right. Well, I see no hands raised at this stage. If you do need to come back to it, please do. The group responding to the Section 4 of the RFP met for the first time earlier this week. And whilst in some ways you might see it as premature to be looking at the implications of RFP 3, it makes sense, I think we felt, to start to structure that and think about how that response may be made. So that's the reason for pulling that together and getting that group ready. It has joint leads in the form of Robert Guerra and Siva. I think Siva was unable to make the meeting on earlier this week, so I'm expecting that Robert Guerra will report to us and just give us an input on that. So, Robert, if you're ready and able to do that, let me hand over to you for an update on RFP 4.
Sure. I'm on the call. Thank you. It's Robert Guerra for the record. We had a first call earlier this week on RFP 4, where I mentioned specifically that we're waiting for RFP 3 and talked about if we could try to get some conversation and some details on the first two of the 5 points, which aren't as related to the RFP 3. And then the rest we're waiting for RFP 3. We have another call that I hope will have more substantive progress, some first review of RFP 3, and I believe that call is scheduled for tomorrow at noon UTC. And so we'll probably defer out, but I think I think the big question for the RFP 4 group is just given the incredibly ultra small short timeline, is to what extent should we be building out some text to be recommended for the draft that comes out on Monday. I think that was one of the big question out from the group call the other day. And so I'd be keen to have that conversation with you and with others on this call, kind of what's expected from RFP 4, and if there's no doubt there will be more substantive text that will need to be developed. Does that all need to be developed by Monday, or can we develop something short in terms of some key sentiment from this community, and then as we capture comments after this coming Monday, build up RFP 4. So those are some very quick comments from someone who's decaffeinated at this point in the morning, and there'll be more of an update after the call tomorrow.
Thank you, Robert. Let me pause now and see if there are any questions or responses to your points and note of the fact that there is a call 1300 UTC tomorrow. I'd encourage anyone who is able to do so to participate tomorrow, both those that are nominally signed up to the group and anyone else who, to the RFP4 subgroup or working group, and anyone else who has an interest in or ability to participate. We need all the help we can get to move this substantial work forward at the kind of pace we need to do so. Let me move on then to the, what I expect is likely to be the substance of this meeting and call, or we expect, and that's the opportunity to start to talk through and respond to the draft proposal. Now, as we originally structured the agenda, we had two separate items: one, review the draft proposal, and two, identify key issues for public comment. And then in reviewing that agenda, it struck us that actually really these two may go hand in hand. So as you review the draft proposal and comment on any particular key areas that you see fit to do so, it would be very useful if you could think about highlighting, or indeed separately highlight, areas which you think are particularly pertinent for public comment, because the way we've thought about this and the way it seems to have been effectively done in the past before is when the group working on this kind of task actually pulls out key questions that they would like public comment or input on. It's not to say that the public comment should exclusively focus on those areas, but nevertheless it is very helpful to perhaps guide the response in areas where the group particularly feels a need for substantial public input. I'm not 100% sure how we should do this, whether we should, it occurs to me, I was expecting that there'd be a significant, thanks Milton for that on the specific questions. I'm open to suggestions here. I mean, I don't know, I mean, how, whether we should focus on sequentially going through the document. That may be useful. I suspect the substance is on in and around RFP 3, although clearly the document does include responses to RFP 1, 2A, 2B, or 1, 2, 3, and starts to pick up 4, 5, and 6, although it's thin to non-existent in those later areas. So maybe you can give me some guidance if you'd like to just pick straight up on different areas. I see a suggestion from Matthew Shears that we start with 3, and since that's the substance, but let's do that. If that's the suggestion, let's consider diving straight into 3. But that doesn't preclude anyone from saying, I have a comment on 1 or 2 that I'd like to draw your attention to. But it seems to me that a sequential walkthrough might be a little painful, and we should really just open it up to the floor to points of substance, and in particular, let's kick off with 3 then. Alan, I see your hand is up. Please feel free to open.
Yes,
open
thank up. You. And oh. I too am not quite caffeinated yet, so forgive me if I'm not quite as clear as I might otherwise be. I ended the meeting, or close to ended the meeting, with some strong statements that I and some of my fellows, among others, had some severe problems with the proposal. And I'd like to just elaborate on a few of them. I'm going to be doing it in writing in a fair amount of detail, but I'd like to say it just so people understand where it's coming from at the very start. There were a number of directions that were taken by the working group as we were meeting, and I want to carefully say I don't think that's a reflection on the chairs ignoring things that were said. It's just in the dynamic of as we're speaking and people, there's always a queue of speakers. Sometimes it's easy to pass over something which is somewhat different than the general trend, and I think that happened a number of times, and ultimately, unfortunately, but nevertheless. We have a number of very specific problems with the with the proposal, and I'll go over them as bullets without going into too much detail. The first one is the jurisdiction of the contracting entity. We think it's going to be very problematic in finding one. Not so much because there aren't possible options, but because various parties who have to agree to this, both the stakeholders and ultimately the NTIA, I think are going to have diametrically opposed views as to what a satisfactory jurisdiction is. We're very concerned about capturability of the whole process. A lot of the concerns of building this this new structure are to avoid capturability issues or possible capturability issues within ICANN. And there's a significant problem, we believe, in the new structure. There's an unanswered question of cost. How is this entity going to be funded, especially in a scenario where ICANN is no longer part of the picture? We have some strong concerns whether what is being described will actually be acceptable to NTIA, and obviously we're not the judge of that, but there are some problems. We think that there may well be integration problems with the other proposals that the ICG is going to have to deal with. We are very worried about who convenes this new review panel, the multi-stakeholder review panel, again, in a scenario where ICANN is no longer part of the IANA process. Just who convenes this, who funds it, how do we make sure that organ, that part of the operation is not subject to capture? And, of course, there's costs associated with that, and you know, there's a lot of problems that we've glossed over saying, you know, there's no problem, we know how to do it. But in many of these things, we know how to do it within the ICANN context. And it's not clear we know how to do it outside and know how to do it in such a way that it will remain resilient. And that's a quick summary. There's some other points I won't go into in detail. And I just wanted to put them in the air right now to, if nothing else, alert people for what's coming and possibly have more discussion on it here. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. It's useful to have that input. My only initial reaction is that you know, I just wouldn't like it to be thought that we had just reacting a little to the thought of having glossed over these. I mean, I think that the key point is we've effectively got a proposal that has potentially issues with it, and the purpose of this follow-up call and any other dialogue online and however we handle this is specifically to avoid glossing over substantial issues and to flush them out, to debate them and try and... So I think those are some valid points. I just reacting to the suggestion that we might maybe unwilling or unable to deal with them. I think we should confront them, and I'd be welcome any reactions or responses.
Thank you, Jonathan. But if I may say one more thing, I don't want to give the impression that everything that we did, you know, that we're trashing, or I'm trashing everything that we did. There are whole aspects of it that I think we did that I think are important and need to be preserved regardless. The appeals mechanism is one of them. That is a very different issue from what we talked, how we've operated right now, not an issue, but a mechanism, and I believe it will be essential to keep that in any type of model we go forward. And there's a number of other things we did. So it's not an issue of, you know, let's tear it down and we wasted the time. It's just that some of the components have questions that do not have obvious answers, at least in my mind, and enough questions together question the model. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Alan. Thanks for those valid points or questions, at least. That's Alan Greenberg for the record. Let me hand over to Milton, whose hand is up. Go ahead, Milton.
Okay. So this is Milton Mueller. Can people hear me? Okay. I liked your suggestion, Jonathan, that we begin to think about areas of questions to ask in our comment period, and I think it's really the best way to address the concerns that Alan has. I can think of, wasn't really fully prepared for that question, even though I think it's a good one, so I've been rapidly trying to throw together some things that I think we should be asking about. One of them is the legal form of the contracting authority and its jurisdiction. I'm not a lawyer and really have no idea how that question would be answered, but I suspect it's going to be a significant one to have this shell that is sitting there with nothing in it or no one in it, but somehow has the authority to issue the IANA contract. It sounds like lawyers will have to work some kind of magic there. Not that I'm criticizing the idea, I just want to know how that works. The other question would be about the composition of the periodic review team. How would that be determined, bearing in mind the need for the group to be both informed about but independent of ICANN? The stress test idea, we could ask, you know, are there any weaknesses in the structure that would lead to it being captured? One thing I don't, you know, relating to Alan's comments, there are two things that I think it's not. Hello?
Hi, Milton. I just want to interrupt you for a moment. There's a bit of distortion. You're very clear, but then occasionally it's distorting. I wonder if it's about proximity to the mic. So I really want to make sure these points are clear to everyone. So if maybe that's an issue. If you could just bring that to your attention. Thanks. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, I'm trying to turn from the computer to notes that I've written. So maybe that's what's happening. So with respect to Alan raised two points that I kind of want to respond to. In terms of acceptability to the NTIA, I don't think it's useful to raise that issue unless you are identifying one of the particular criteria that the NTIA identified that had to be met and saying that a specific thing in the plan is violating or contradicting that element. So I can't see anything in this plan that contradicts anything that the NTIA set out as a requirement. The other thing is integration with other proposals. I really don't think it's useful for us to worry about that at the moment. We are charged to come up with a proposal that meets the needs and consensus of the NAMES community. And it's really step two for the ICG to worry about how those things work together. And if they don't work together, then it'll get sent back to us. But you don't even know what the other proposals are yet. So, again, it's not useful to worry about that. That's all for now.
Thanks, Milton. I've got Greg, and then I'm going to let me perhaps pick up just a couple of points before we go to Greg that have come up in the chat. I mean, there was some support for Sean from Alan's point of views. A question from Matthew Shears relating to how the contracting company will take action if it has no staff, et cetera. In other words, how will it – maybe that's something Greg may even respond to. And Paul Kane notes that he sees this as a starting point, has small issues, but welcome the document to ensure the plan is on track. Greg Shatton, over to you.
Good morning. It's Greg Shatton for the record. I guess what Paul said in the chat kind of sets up my comment that this is the paper is a starting point. We are at a very what I would think to be an active and engaged part of the process. The fact that we have a Monday deadline notwithstanding, this is the process of engaging. And in listening to what Alan was saying, that they're going to write a response, I would suggest that maybe a different approach is called for, not that there should be nothing written, but rather that by saying that we're going to write a long point-by-point kind of critique of issues, that's almost withdrawing from the process in a sense and writing to the process when we're all here. We are in the room, so to speak. Obviously, we're not all here. You know, some people are not on the call, but this is the time to deal with these. These are live issues. This is not a process where the what we have here is fully baked. This is not intended to be a kind of a process where people are already kind of firming up minority statements. So, you know, rather than writing points kind of from outside the walls, to some extent, I suggest that both those, you know, whoever you are in the group, whatever your views are, it's time to, you know, they should be put out in a way that they can be part of a dialogue. This is the place to start or continue that dialogue. After a couple of hours, the list will be a place to continue that dialogue. So I think that we are all still in the process, and the problem with long written statements is that they then need to be picked apart so that they can even be responded to, and they will never or shouldn't be responded to in toto, because that's, you know, very difficult to kind of integrate and to move forward. You know, we need to work on this document rather than to kind of, you know, prepare statements about it. So the reason I'm saying that is not because I don't value the input that statement would bring to the table, but rather because I value it more than that. I value it because it needs to be in the process, and being in the process, it needs to be done in a somewhat more granular way so that we can listen to these concerns and respond to them and engage in a dialogue about them and see what that does to improve our output. I wrote down the points here. These are all good points. To some extent, they may have been dealt with. To some extent, they haven't been dealt with. They certainly need to be dealt with. We need to figure out how to deal with them. Writing papers about them, I don't think we're at that point yet where that's the kind of the best process approach. The substance may be identical, but I think we need to tackle these points in an engaged and working group sort of way. So I invite some thought on that, and especially invite us to start dealing with these in whatever order we want to. In terms of the particular question that was asked in the chat, I think by Matthew, the chat seems to have been moving very quickly after that. How will the contracting company take action? My initial thought on that, and it's just me speaking, is that these actions would be delegated to the PRT. It's also possible that there could be an administrator or a secretariat, but I think the point is that its actions need to be controlled by the multi-stakeholder community and not have a position like a CEO who has wide latitude to kind of sally forth kind of come back and, you know, ask for forgiveness rather than beg for permission when things need to be taken care of. So the idea is that the multi-stakeholder multitude of the PRT may not be a multitude, but it represents the multitude. It is certainly where the action is, and can certainly be delegated to take those actions. So thank you.
Thanks, Greg, and I'm glad you picked up on that point about the company, the contracting entity, and whether or not it has staff, or how it exists, because that seems to have been a theme. I know I've recently picked it up on List, and others have. I mean, my 2 cents worth on that is, in a sense, providing one has the principle that you've just described, it's almost irrelevant whether there are staff or not. The principle is that it's directed to act. Quite how it acts mechanically is, it may need one or two people, as you said. One other point I'm aware of before handing over to Alan, and I'll just make a note of this, is that there was some other comment and potentially criticism coming out of Frankfurt that we hadn't sufficiently developed the hooks or links into the parallel and related and interconnected work on accountability. So that's an open challenge that we need to work with. And in part, I stick by what I said in the sense that the accountability work streams have yet to kick off in earnest, but it is something that this group needs to be cognizant of, the requirement to have those hooks. Alan, let me hand over to you. Alan Greenberg.
Thank you very much. In response to Greg, I'd be glad if the group wants to entertain me talking more. I'd be glad to go into a little bit more detail on just the first item, perhaps, and that is the contracting entity. The kinds of questions we're looking at are, you know, we've brushed over a lot of things saying, yes, there are details to be worked out, but the details are exceedingly important. We are talking about a contracting entity, and we're using that word implying it's not a company. It's likely to be a company of some sort in some jurisdiction, which is very, very lightweight. It may not have a board. It may not have any employees. At the same time, it is going to have the crucial role of issuing contracts, enforcing contracts, because ultimately, if the contractee is not doing the job, we're not going to wait. We don't want them to wait around for another 6 years until the contract is up. They're going to have to take action. The group is going to somehow have the expertise and the ability to, at contract time, and depending on how we carry this out, there may be periodic and, in some people's minds, very regular RFPs. It takes a lot of resources to put together an RFP. You first, before you do that, you probably want to go out to the community and ask them what is it they're looking for this time around, as the NTIA has done. When the RFP responses come in, you need an ability to evaluate it. You need to do all of those things in a way that is completely and utterly uncapturable. And those are far from little details at that point. You know, you've got a company that shrinks from almost nothing to a large operational entity to send out, to create RFPs, to communicate with the public, to evaluate them, to issue contracts, to enforce those contracts. And yet, we're at the same time saying, well, maybe there's no people. And these, I think, are real contradictions in terms. And if it's that small and flexible, how do we know it can't be captured? So just on that one item of the contracting entity, we've already mentioned the jurisdiction. There are so many questions that bring into mind the overall question of, is it really a viable plan? Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. I think we should attempt to address that as best as we can, because clearly it's what we don't want to be putting out is something which has any substantial concern about its fundamental viability. Greg.
Hi, it's Greg Chapman again. I think these are all excellent points and do think it's good that some, you know, any member of the group has been, you know, thoughtful enough, or any members of the group been thoughtful enough to, you know, to put together a list, and I think this is the right way to deal with them. In terms of glossing over, we did manage to fill, maybe even overfill, two full days, and if there had been a day three, I'm sure that these issues would have been dealt with in more detail. In a sense, this is day three. Every day before this, and every day up until December 1st, is day three of the face-to-face, in one sense. I think in terms of these particular questions, in my view, I see Elise in the chat saying what I was going to say, is that the action would be taken by the PRT. I agree that these are not insignificant tasks, both enforcing the contract and creating a new RFP, which is
either a possibility or a mandate, depending upon where we take that discussion. But certainly a possibility, I would think. That's certainly at least a possibility. My view is that the PRP would act very much as this group is acting, and you raise this important question of funding. Clearly, some of us, and nobody here, we, is, getting paid per se, although we're all here in some fashion. But we also have, the excellent support of staff on this that has taken a lot of the blocking and tackling for the group. And that unless the PRT is going to be an ICANN structure and take advantage of ICANN resources, and as we are doing here, it would need to be funded and resourced. That's one answer to that is to make it an ICANN structure. That, of course, raises other questions. But that is one answer. The other answer is that this, could be a non-cost-free contract, that there, should be a charge or an amount that's set either on a fee-for-service basis or an annual basis that I can pay for the privilege of being the IANA, which, on the open market would possibly be worth something. So, those are our thoughts on funding. On capturability, I think that begins with the documents that create the entity. And by entity, when I use the word entity in talking, I'm thinking of something that has formal legal personality and existence. So it would be a company, a nonprofit corporation would be my suggestion, and that it's created so that its mandate is very limited, and that it has in its articles and bylaws, for instance, a prohibition against the company itself, which would have to have some directors and officers, at least in the formal sense, in order to satisfy most jurisdictions, need to have some form of people in those roles, but that their roles would be very constrained. And, for instance, that they would have, particularly that there would be a prohibition against changing the bylaws or against changing the bylaws unless, certain steps were taken that would involve the PRT or some other multi-stakeholder process. As I noted, these are a lot of different concepts that have been raised, and there are a lot of hands in the queue. So any one of these could be the subject of greater discussion. Now I'll stop talking and go back into listening mode. Thanks.
Thanks, Craig. Let's go straight on then with responses or comments in and around these issues. I've got Olivier next in the queue.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's Olivier Carpano-Blanc speaking, and what Greg has just been telling us has been pretty helpful. I'm of the same view as Alan Greenberg, by the way, and of course, as you know, following my statement in Frankfurt, we in At Large have conducted some working group meetings that deal specifically with these issues, and I think that it might have been misinterpreted that by submitting written, the issues in writing, I think it's more of a case of first us being able to articulate these correctly so as not to have any confusion with where our concern is. But then also, I think that these are not issues that can just be dealt with in one conference call. I'm looking here at the document that we received in our mailbox, the version 1.6, is it? The one that will be sent to the public consultation. Just as a trivial matter, the numbering, you're going to have to look at the numbering of the pages because it resets itself to one in several locations. And but then the concern I have, just looking at it now, I've noticed that the flow charts, which we had worked on, were not included in that, or at least I didn't see them in there. We have huge appendices. We've done a lot of homework and background work, all the basic stuff that needed to be done. But as far as the actual proposal is concerned, and the real key hot potatoes being those four bodies that we have, this is just described in a few lines at the end of page, well, what's currently page 25 and the beginning of page 26. And yet these are where we have, I would say, the majority of our concerns. The devil is in the details with this. You can have something like this that's going to be working perfectly well in a certain form, or that's going to be an absolute nightmare and will lead to a whole lot of problems in a different form. And that's what we need to focus on. What I would suggest is perhaps we continue, going in depth on a conference call is going to be really hard, except if we have a five-hour conference call, one of these marathon things. But I would say if we open different threads on the mailing lists on each one of these issues, so like a thread about the contracts co, a thread about the multi-stakeholder periodic review team, and so on, then we'll probably be able to really isolate those problems and find some solutions to them or find some way out to allay the fears that we have. Thank you.
Thanks, Olivier. Thank you for bringing us up in with a slightly different perspective, and also for the practical suggestion. I mean, I clearly feel, and we feel that there's a need to air the overarching concerns or issues, but there's also, as you essentially alluded to there, a need to turn those into practical suggestions and modifications of wording, and as I asked for at the beginning, perhaps directions on key questions for public comment. So let's continue along this line, but bear in mind that the point you have made, and we will need to get to ultimately, which is to think also about specific proposals for change or modification, which, as you say, may well be effectively done online as well, and there's clearly a need to simply thrash this out a little at a higher level as well, but we need to sort of do both. Chuck, you're next in the queue.
Thanks, Jonathan, and thanks to all for the good discussion. This is Chuck speaking. There have been a lot of comments and good questions asked about the contracting entity, and I on the list and in this call today already, and I think we'll see the same thing in the public comment period. And I'm not an attorney, so I don't have any legal expertise. I respect the legal expertise that we have on this group, and I listen to it. But it seems to me that we very quickly need some independent contracting legal expertise to flesh out some of the details and issues we'll have to deal with as we refine the details of that contracting entity, and not just the contracting entity, but its relationship with the periodic review team and how all that works from a legal perspective. So my question is, how do we do that? I don't think we can wait. I think that should be started right now. So how do we get that independent legal advice, and how is it funded? I think that should be started in the next few days. If we wait until the end of the comment period, it's way too late.
Thanks, Chuck. That's a good point. Perhaps I should, I'm just wondering, I'd very much like to pick that up, but I'm respectful of the queue as well. So perhaps I could ask people to think about that as well, both in terms of how we do that and potentially how we fund it, although I my understanding is that at least since ICANN is sponsoring this process, that we could reasonably ask for support for that kind of activity, but there may be other views on that. So let me make sure that question is properly posed, as you have done, Chuck, and that others think about their responses to that, and in the meantime defer to others in the queue, which is currently Lisa, followed by Milton. Lisa, go ahead.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's Lisa for the record. Well, my comment is actually on a concern I've seen raised on the list, and also it was also raised in Frankfurt about the accountability track and how that we coordinate with those. I just want to make sure that everyone knows that you, Jonathan and I will be in contact with the chairs of the accountability drafting team, and we'd like we'll try to ensure that there's a connection to this group. So, and we'll get back regarding this on a later call. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. That's helpful to bring that up. That's useful. Thank you. But again, a reminder, if anyone has any comment or guidance on that, that's one of the other big themes, is the interrelationship with the accountability work. So we welcome any input there as well. Milton.
Hello. This is Milton Mueller. So I'm a bit confused about the objective of our discussion. I would put it this way. Are we taking this draft that we have in front of us as a given that we are going to submit for public comment, and we are trying to decide what questions we want to ask the public to address specifically about it? Or are we still modifying this document in ways that we think will address some of the ambiguities or weaknesses? Once we answer that question, I would bring up another point, which I think there was some interesting discussion that requires some resolution. And that has to do with the approval function. I was under the impression, based on my reading of the transcript, that we had decided there didn't need to be an approval function, that the, you know, I have always suspected that the NTIA's actual review of the root zone changes was kind of a fifth wheel in the process. However, there was some discussion of somebody taking responsibility for the decision, somebody having liability. I just want to know whether the proposal we have in front of us has thought that through, and that would be another issue for us to raise as a question that we wanted input on, if indeed this is the draft that's going out for public comment.
Okay, Milton, thank you. I will aim to respond to that, and then I will pause immediately afterwards to make sure that my responses are acceptable to others. First of all, to your first question, my view is that this is a draft of the document that will go out for public comment. It is the basis of that document, but it is subject to modification based on this discussion and further discussion that may take place over the next day or two on the list. So it remains work in progress, but we should view it as the substance of what will be sent out for public comment. To your second question, I think that in parallel with that, and actually your point on the approval function is a good one, we should seek key points for which there with public comment is required. So it was my view that we could do both of those, propose modifications and changes to the document and call out substantial issues which were necessary or highly desirable for public comment. As to the specifics of the approval function, yes, that was the sense of where we got to in Frankfurt. As to whether it's a done, in other words, to do away with the approval function, but I do recall that there have been comments to the contrary since then. So clearly, I think the principle we were working to is to ensure that whilst everything didn't remain wide open indefinitely, there has to be the opportunity for further criticism or refinement or appraisal of even the more substantial decisions. So it's a delicate balance between pushing this forward and respecting the required timetable and yet making sure that issues aren't shut out for further comment on substance or refinement. Greg, go ahead. or hang on, let me pause a moment. Before I go to Greg in the queue, does anyone have any issue or, you know, counterpoint? Or I see Greg put plus one in the comment, but if there are any concerns with what I've just said, please, you know, and Milton acknowledges it, so that's helpful. Thanks, Milton. But if there are any concerns or comments, please go ahead now and make yourself known ahead of Greg. All right, let me let Greg go ahead, but if you do take issue with what I said, please flag it.
Thanks, Jonathan. Greg Shatton for the record. You know, looking, I'm following up particularly on the point on independent legal advice, which I would welcome, particularly because I am a lawyer and have been using some of my experience in that area here, but I, you know, would not set myself up as counsel to the committee by any stretch of the imagination. In particular, because even though I've worked in large corporate law firms and have worked on many, many, many transactions, have represented many corporations and other things, I am not a super specialist in corporate structuring or transactional structuring. If a client came to me or my firm and said, this is the transaction we wanted to do, first thing I would do is go to one of our corporate M&A specialists, mergers and acquisition specialists, probably would in turn go to one of our tax guys, even though this is a nonprofit. They're often, you know, really, they should be called structuring people rather than tax people, because that's what they do a lot of the time. They have a lot of knowledge of what goes on in different jurisdictions, but they also have local law experts that they would tend to call on. And, you know, in the world we live in today, while, of course, there are lawyers in every jurisdiction who can do this, there is a tendency for the lead often to be taken by U.S. or U.K. lawyers who are then, or, you know, wherever they may be, are kind of headmanning things and getting local lawyers involved, you know, for issues of you know, deeper local expertise. And we're not obviously following that model here, but yet this has all of the complexities of many corporate transactions and additional complexities as well, since in corporate transactions you don't set up independent appeals panels. You clearly do have dispute resolution issues, you know, both in the contract and sometimes outside of it, but we have all those challenges. So I mean, I think that getting independent legal counsel in here who would have those skill sets and be able to perform kind of an independent legal function, I think would be important. I don't think we need to decide the jurisdiction before we ask, you know, for that because of what I just said. But you know, as they go forward, they may say, well, if you're going to look to incorporate here, or if you have these choices, this is the type of structure you want. These jurisdictions are best for it. These states are best for it. And if you go here, you're going to have other problems and issues. But, you know, I will, again, go back into kind of listening mode. But I think that is it's an excellent suggestion. It would actually give me a little bit of comfort to have that involvement at the next level. You know, alternatively, I would call in chips and favors from people I know who do that because they would be able to get some level of advice, informed advice on all of that, but that's not as transparent as having, you know, actual counsel to the committee for these important questions. Thanks.
Okay, so recognizing that we are coming to around halfway through the call, I would think that we've got around half an hour more at least if we need it to cover this. And the kind of themes that seem to be emerging, not to close off any areas, but clearly it's this issue of key elements of the structure and in particular the prospect of obtaining independent legal advice for one or two key components of it. There's the links and relationship into the accountability and the and how that may or may not impact our timing. And then there is the working assumption that we will proceed to public comment with this as the fundamental document, subject to further modification here or in the days to come. If I'm missing a substantial sub theme or key point, please flag it with me. But you know, be very helpful to get as much comment or input around those. And of course, as we said at the outset, the key points for if there are critical overarching points for which public comment needs to be sought, teasing those out as well. I note the point from Alan McGillifray in the chat, and recognizing the and others, in fact, recognizing the fact that the sequencing of the accountability track is certainly somewhat out of sync. There's a few other questions that really emerge, and let me put those to you. I mean, first of all, how do we obtain modifications? I think we had a very practical proposal from Olivier that we break the RFP 3 down into the subcomponents, in particular at least around the different substructures proposed, and bring some threads up there for practical threads on the mailing list for practical proposals to modify, implement those. We will need to produce a cutoff date, because getting a draft out on December 1st will need a cutoff point at minimum 24 hours before we schedule to publish it, so that we can integrate comments to date on that. And I guess there's an issue of how it's something we'll have to make sure we do have a pens down point at some point where we stabilize a document that at least the co-chairs will have to sign off on, if not the respective team leads, if you like. So any comments or issues in and around noise coming in on the line again, in and around process and how we get this this document, if there are any issues that we need to think about there in terms of process and getting this out for public comment by the 1st. Alan Greenberg, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I think one of the issues is clearly with the deadline of Monday, and it's a holiday weekend for some people, we are not going to address all of the questions and fix the draft at this point. Some issues may well be addressed, but in general, all we can do is raise them or raise potential answers. I think it's important that the draft that comes out integrate or at least mention to some extent, whether it's in line or in an appendix or something, the kinds of issues that have been raised and are not answered, so that the community has sort of the full view of what it's like, and doesn't have to read quite as if they've never mentioned it before. I'm not quite sure how that gets done. We have some really capable drafting staff, so I don't have a lot of fear that we can't. was what I said intelligible, or do I need to say it again?
I think you started off okay, but perhaps you could summarize the early part and then just make sure that the latter was covered, Alan.
Okay, thank you. I just want to make sure we're not likely to fix all the problems at this point, given a Monday deadline and a holiday week. Okay, I'll start again for a moment. Given that we won't be able to fix all the problems, I want to make sure that the draft that comes out for public comment somehow captures the issues that have been raised, perhaps summarized, so that people don't have to reinvent them and don't think that they weren't considered at all in this discussion. And I have full capability in our drafting staff to be able to do that, but I just want to make sure it is an integral part of the document that comes out and incorporated in such a way that the people who do not choose to read a full 200-page document or whatever it is are aware of them, if not the detail, that at least that there are questions raised that will need to be addressed. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And perhaps even those are questions for response in the public comment. You know, that they may be one and the same thing in a way.
Sure.
Let me defer to Chuck, who's next in the queue.
Thanks, Jonathan. Chuck speaking again, and I'd like to make a suggestion in terms of an action item for the next few days. It seems to me it would be very helpful if on the list we all contribute to questions that we would like the community to respond to, as well as issues that we may want them to comment on. Some of that has already gone on, and we need to capture that as well. But I think we need to have a deadline of probably no later than Saturday for discussion on that on the list. And then I would recommend that we give the co-chairs the authority to take that input and formulate the questions and issues that we specifically want comment on so that the document can be ready on Monday.
Thanks, Chuck. That kind of practical suggestion is very helpful. So proposing that the questions and issues are raised by the end of Saturday and then those are formulated into Q&A / questions and issues thereafter for publication on Monday, including other modifications to the document. Greg Chatan, you're next.
Hi, Greg Chatan, for the record. I am in agreement with what Chuck was saying. I think those roughly a timeline sound good. You know, I, for one, you know, given although this is a holiday weekend, I was not expecting to spend the next several days, you know, on figuring out what to do with leftover turkey to the exclusion of the work here. And maybe that's sad, but I'm sure that there are others who are equally pathetic in their devotion to getting this done. I think in terms of just timing, I would say that, you know, Monday, I'm assuming Monday at least goes up until 2359 UTC. If not further, noting that the ICANN has a habit of releasing things at 5 o'clock p.m. Pacific time, meaning 8 p.m. New York time and overnight in Europe. That's probably not what's intended by Monday, but we certainly should wring as much out of Monday as we need to in terms of kind of polishing off time so that we can get this done. And certainly, you know, as I say, I'm, you know, intending to put in whatever time I can to, you know, help move the process forward, consistent with not being available this evening for several hours, because I will be spending that time dealing with Kirby. Thank you.
Thanks. And in direct response, Greg, to one point of that, it's Jonathan speaking. I know that the support staff we're relying on are significantly based in North American time zones, possibly even as far west as LA. So it may well be that we run beyond 2359 UTC on Monday and stretch the absolute max out of Monday, December 1st. But in any event, that's the day we're currently working to. good point from Robert in the chat as well. Robert Garrett raises the point that one area we could seek input on is on the transition implications. It's something where instead of figuring those all out ourselves, having put what is a substantial proposal out for public comment, the implications of that will also flush out issues, and I can imagine that may be another angle at looking at the implications of all of this. Good. Thank you, Mark Covell from the UK, with your comments on supporting the issue for public comment and of the document in an evolved format from where it currently is, including some framing of the questioning and requirement for input. Got hands up from Milton and Chuck, so go ahead, Milton.
Yes, Milton Mueller again. I would like to, if we can still modify this document, is it possible to flesh out at all the composition and formation of the PRT, the Periodic Review Team? And Avery raised some questions on the list today about its relationship to the customer, the IANA Customer Standing Committee. And we had a discussion about that among the non-commercial stakeholder group, in which we were noodling over the distinction between the standing committee and the periodic nature of the review team. We liked the idea that there was a standing committee that would be constantly monitoring things, but we thought that some of the things that might need to be monitored would not just be pure operational performance, SLA kinds of things, but might be some of the broader issues related to whether the IANA is properly following policy. And so then you get into a tension between keeping the standing committee focused on direct customers, which is a good thing in our opinion, versus making sure that the periodic review team can act in a timely and appropriate manner, which would indicate that it would need possibly some standing capabilities of itself. So I would like, you know, for people to maybe propose more detail about the periodic review team and how it works, who is on it, how it's formed, and whether it is an ongoing thing or simply literally something that just springs into existence on some kind of a, let's say, 3 or 5 or 6 year cycle. I would really like to have more detail about that.
A couple of comments, Milton, from Jonathan, and then I'll see if others come in on that. Certainly, my understanding was that the periodicity wasn't as long as 3 years, that it would be probably a minimum of 1 year and ad hoc as necessary. Composition, while I won't presuppose that, but the composition was at least nominally agreed in terms of seats and not necessarily who was occupying those seats, you know, the actual individuals. Those are a couple of understandings that I took away of where we were at present. So it could be convened at potentially short notice should an issue arise, but the idea was to have it not permanently convened and that the sort of permanent and ongoing attention was paid to activity by the CSC. So it's really a matter of deciding what goes in what bucket of responsibility and whether that covers the full spectrum, I suppose. Let me defer now to Chuck, who may not be responding to this since his hand was up beforehand, but that's a little bit of my 2 cents worth on that. Chuck, go ahead.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's not about that. So if you want me to come back later while you discuss this, I'm okay with that.
Difficult to manage parallel queues, Chuck. So I think we'll just go ahead and just be aware that others might come back in on those points to the extent that I've either misunderstood them or that others have a different view.
Thanks, Jonathan. Chuck again. this is a, just a practical suggestion with regard to the request for comments, and I know I'm preaching to the choir for many of you, including our leaders. But to the extent that we can guide the public comments in terms of how we want them to come back, it will really help us in the review and analysis and response to those comments after the comment period is over. So just throw that out. I know many of you are already aware of that, but everything we can do there will really help us later on.
Thanks, Chuck. Agreed. Greg?
Hi, Greg Chapman for the record, and following up on Milton. First, I think, as you said, composition, I think, was at least somewhat agreed as being broadly multi-stakeholder for the periodic review team. And I felt, I think, even though obviously I was in the room when it happened, the term periodic is somewhat unfortunate in the title of this group, and I think at some point we had taken it out, but then it came back in, maybe for lack of something better or because review team seemed too short. But I think that the periodicity is only one function of this group. As said, it's also there for escalation for issues that are tagged by the CSC. And that they can't quickly resolve. And I agree with what I saw Aubrey saying in the chat, and I think Milton may have had an email before that had a list of certain things on top of kind of pure SLA concerns that should be, within the remit of this group to deal with. And I think he mentioned them as well. And broadly speaking, I agree with that. The remit of this group can't be so narrow that it can't take notice. The way I view it is it's almost like the first-level help desk, in a sense. Not that I would think of them as a help desk, but, there's first-level support and then there's second-level support. The CSC, functions as, in a sense, first-level support. Second-level support is kind of always there to be called on, but if they're not called on, hopefully they don't need to sit around and justify their own existence, having meetings that have nothing on the agenda. So in that sense, I think the PRT is, to some extent, periodic, but it's not periodic so much as it is proactive periodically and reactive in between those times. So maybe we can call it the periodic reactive team. So those are some thoughts on that particular point. And in terms of the composition of the CSC, I think that's kind of related to this. My belief is that while it should be kind of customer-focused, that it should have liaisons from the other stakeholder groups, and ideally those who would be particularly well-suited to dealing with the issues that the CSC will be dealing with. I think that also provides a useful check and balance on the customer committee so that it doesn't become a uni-stakeholder. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg. That helps clarify elements of that. Let me go straight to Milton.
Yes, Milton Mueller. So I still think there's a bit of a contradiction here, not a contradiction, but kind of confusion about the nature of these two entities. So the periodic review team, as I understand it, is basically what decides who gets the IANA contract on a rotating basis according to some periodic cycle that we define, and that reviews the entire record and reviews who the alternatives are to the existing IANA, and it makes a recommendation to the contracting entity. And I think that's a coherent idea, and I think it's a good idea. I do not think it should be standing. I do not think it should be it should be duplicating the work of the CSC. I think the only issue here that needs to be cleared up is what the scope of the customer standing committee, and whether it is indeed a customer standing committee or a multi-stakeholder committee that kind of seems to duplicate the PRT. So as far as I could say, the only way to square that circle would be to keep the customer standing committee very focused on registries and people who are actually using the IANA, but possibly to have a couple of experts on there who are not registries per se, but are experts in security or other kinds of technical and operational issues that might occur in the course of the ongoing execution of the IANA functions.
Thanks, Milton. Thanks, Greg. I just make the point that I think that, to my mind, there's a consistency between your two points, and that the experts that you referred to, Milton, could be the liaisons that Greg referred to, and that means that there's an opportunity for specialists or supplementary input into the customer service function. One other point you made, Milton, which is that the PRT would recommend to the contracting co. My understanding is that the contracting co has no discretion. The contracting co does what it is told by the PRT. Olivier.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's Olivier speaking. I'd like to draw your attention to the discussion in the chat at the moment, where Alan asks, with regards to the CSC, why would we think that this CSC would raise alarms if they're happy that a specific policy is not being followed? And in addition to this, I think that goes back to the discussion that we had about what the CSC would be doing, whether it would work primarily just on SLAs, or whether it would actually go further than that and perform its own reviews. And that's going to be crucial to then how we want to structure the CSC itself. Thank you.
Thanks, Olivia. I'm not sure if you suggested that the CSC would be about evaluating policy, whether policy was followed or not. My understanding is that that's not in scope for the CSC. That's really something which is a given and is ultimately a point of either escalation and or arbitration should policy be questioned, should the entity not be, should policy not be being followed. A bunch of hands come up.
Jonathan, if I can respond, please.
Please do, Olivier.
Yeah, thank you, Jonathan. It's Olivier speaking. If the policy is not being followed, who flags that? And that's the crux of the question. If no one on the CSC, if it's in nobody on the CSC, nobody's advantage on the CSC to flag that policy is not being followed, then what happens? That's the question. Thank you.
Okay, I'll defer to others to answer that question, but what I will say is that again, I would expect, and we should expect, I think, that all discussion, and this goes to the value of the input from, if they were to be called liaisons, others, that all of this would be transparent. Therefore, it would be evident if something wasn't being followed or listened to. Alan is next in the queue.
Thank you very much. If indeed the CSC is only looking at service levels, then perhaps many of us can live with it only being the interested parties on it. And you know, that needs further discussion, but it's conceivable that we could accept it. But as we go through this conversation, various people keep on saying, no, it should be wider than that. And if we change from just service levels to wider, then the issue that has just been discussed comes up. You know, the nature of the multi-stakeholder model that we have in ICANN is that policy can be enacted which is disagreed with by the party that's affected by it. You know, that's the whole concept of consensus policy. and therefore you cannot presume that the parties affected by it are going to raise the flag, and there's no one else to raise the flag in the environment we're looking at. So either its focus is purely on service levels, then there needs to be someone else who is watching on a regular basis. It's not the contracting entity, because they don't really exist in the dead time in between. It's not the CSC, the CPR, whatever it is called, may not exist at that point, because we're saying it's going to be created when it's needed. We have a gap in this process. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm hearing that we need to do some work on which is what I thought we had already agreed to do, but it feels like we need to do the work on that scope and delineation between the CSC and the PRT. Olivia, is that an old hand? I think it might be an old hand, and Greg, yeah, thank you. Greg, you're next, and then Chuck. Just to give you guys a warning, I think we should probably be wrapping this up around the half-hour point and try and move on to the other items in the agenda and the route to public consultation. Greg.
Thanks. I'll be brief then. I think I would plunk down on the side that the CSC should be, as I say, kind of the first level on a number of things, not just purely service levels, and that's why there should be some membership from outside the directly affected customer community. Whether the term liaison is the right thing for that or not, I don't know. If there's a feeling that liaisons are not members and therefore are more constrained in their actions than other members, or participants in a particular group, then maybe they need to be more than liaisons. But clearly, liaisons are very active in discussion, if the point is to tackle the smaller issues, the resolvable ones, and then escalate the bigger ones, I think it would be rather odd if the liaison, couldn't move the ball at all, even if the customers were saying that they were happy not escalating something. So I think those are details that are, while they are crucially important, we'll just have to continue to focus on them. But I think, as with any exercise that's multi-stakeholder, you try to avoid, capture or ability for a minority to, keep most of the rest of the group from taking action, and we hope that things that we've learned over the years working in a multi-stakeholder fashion will be brought into that. Thanks.
Okay, I've got a queue that we'll work our way through, and it's clear that this is a critical access. So this may well be the focus of our discussion, is this delineation over the next day or two. Chuck.
Thanks, Jonathan. Chuck speaking again. I want to respond to Olivier's question. I think it's a very critical question, and it really has to do with standing to use the binding independent review process. I'd like to refer everyone to one of the tables that is in section 2A, and I know there are quite a few there, that outlines the GTLD steps that lead from policy development all the way up to delegation or redelegation. And it seems to me that we need to define who has standing to appeal something that happens in that process flow at various intervals. For example, and I'll use the GNSO as example, although I'll refer to CCs as well. With regard to policy development, and in particular the implementation of policy, I think the SOs who develop the policy, or in the CCTLD world, it's quite different, and we need to deal with that too. But just in the case of GTLDs, that the GNSO should have the right to use that mechanism if they think that policy was implemented improperly. Now, going down the line further in that table, in the case of a particular delegation or undelegation or redelegation, the registry operator that's involved should be able to use that mechanism to be able to use that review procedure. And in the case of CCTLDs, where governments have a role, it seems reasonable to me that a government would be able to use that process for their specific CCTLD. So, in general, what I'm saying is that one of the things I think we need to do is to develop, and we don't need to do this before Monday, so I'm not suggesting that. We need to be able to define who has standing at those various steps to use that process, and then that becomes the mechanism then in which things can be challenged and who can challenge them.
Thanks, Chuck. That seems to elucidate the position pretty well, and there was, I know there was at least a few indications of support for that thinking in the chat. Peter?
Thank you, Jonathan. This is Peter Haroster from Centre. I want to express my support as well for the last part of what Chuck said. Hello?
Peter, I think we hear you okay now, so try and go ahead again.
Okay, thank you, sorry for that. So support for the second part of what Chuck said. But I want also to express a bit my concern with the wrong logic that I hear applied here. We identify a part of the process that's missing, and that's the policy check, whether policy has been applied correctly. And then we have the Customer Standing Committee, which is supposed to check the proper performance of IANA, and we try to slam the missing process to the CSC. I want to underline that when we started discussing that in Frankfurt, this was to be a pure technical evaluation of the metrics of the IANA service performance, and with reference to Avery's mantra, and something that we've been discussing at length during the principal discussion, is let's keep this lightweight. So at least for the CSC, as far as I'm concerned, and from what I hear from my members, keep it lightweight, keep it focused on a very specific task that it can perform well. Thanks.
Okay, so there's another good way of putting it. Thank you. That we've identified a gap that needs filling. It may be that we're trying to fill the gap in the wrong place. But a couple more in the queue, and then I feel I need to move us on in the agenda to make sure we complete what we need to in the time available. So let me move straight on then after you, Peter, to Amar. Go ahead, Amar.
Thanks, Jonathan. This is Amar. I think I pretty much agree with everything I've been hearing from Peter and Chuck and others, I think we have identified that there is a gap that needs to be filled, but I do not think we've actually identified what the gap is, because we need to make sure that there is no overlap in terms of policy implementation of policy monitoring in the IANA function, and that which should ideally actually happen within the policy development bodies such as the GNSO and perhaps the CCNSO, although I'm not sure exactly how that works. So we haven't actually identified what the gap is, but we do realize there is a gap in terms of monitoring how policy is implement on the IANA side. I also would like to draw attention to the fact that when Avery raised some of her concerns, they did not only includes implementation of policies, but also the need for some expertise to raise flags on other issues such as security. Personally, I'm not sure if this is something that could be included within a service level agreement and as part of the purview of the standing committee or not, but it is probably also something we should consider. Thanks.
Thank you, Amar. Let me defer to Fatima with the last place in the queue. Go ahead, Fatima. I see that your hand is no longer there, which I assume will come back up again if you do need to talk. Alan, you filled that place vacated by Fatima. Let me, since you had the first word, let me give you the last, and I will try and capture where we are. Alan Green.
I wasn't trying to be the last. Just a very quick comment. We're talking about, in some cases, like the CSC, having very narrow remits. Very narrow remits are prone to ignoring the issues that we're not even aware of as we're designing it right now. And I think we need to be very careful that we don't end up accidentally leaving gaps just because we didn't think of some aspect. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Alan. It feels to me like this has been a very productive conversation and a good test of elements of the model. I hope I'm accurate in recognizing that there seems to be a broad recognition of the need to keep moving on the timetable track we're on. The most significant current concern with the timetable track is the interlinking with accountability. That's well flagged, although not well solved. There also seems to be some very practical suggestions and points raised in and around a number of areas that we'll have to pick up. That includes the key elements of structure, whether they legally sound enough to high effect, whether there's the appropriate delineation between key components of the structure. So we've got our work cut out for us to try and push this along further so that it is sufficiently complete for production on Monday and for public comment. Nevertheless, I'd urge all of us to recognize that while some moving parts do need to be at least tightened, the whole point of having a public comment and an ongoing process is to allow for further development of the ideas. So it's really a fine line to tread between having agreement on a conceptual framework and yet recognition that there is the devil is in the detail and work needs to be done there. So thanks for constructive and unique input there. That's very helpful. Further three items that we need to deal with really are, I guess, we have touched on the route to public comment and the desire to put to have questions and comments and input through Saturday, such that we can then through to around, probably around, ideally midday UTC on Saturday, perhaps a little later, but trying to get input in by then such that that can then be integrated into both the revised version of the document and a well-formulated and structured set of questions for public comment. So let's work at that over the next 48 hours or so. We also need to recognize that with having published this, we need to have the webinars, and the webinars are currently planned for the 3rd and 4th of December. That's Wednesday and Thursday next week, where we will have those on a number of different time zones. I think there's three time slots planned currently. I don't know if there are any comments or questions about input or structure for those webinars. Anyone from staff is welcome to comment, or anyone who has a view of what we should be covering and any key points in and around those webinars. Marika, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, this is Marika. I've just posted in the chat the note pod the proposed date and time for those webinars. It may be helpful to talk through how you would like to organize or run those webinars. Are you planning as co-chairs to host and take people through the proposal, or are you looking for involvement of members of the group to assist with that? I'm working with Grace on getting the announcement out in conjunction with the publication of the proposal, so it is a relatively short time frame, but we hope, seeing that there's probably quite some interest in this, that there probably will be quite some participation. So, and of course, anything members of the group can do to promote the webinar will be helpful.
Good question, Marika. I would think for the most part it would be certainly ideal to have both co-chairs on and potentially leading or presenting those webinars, ideally supported by attendance from the sort of RFP team leads. I think that would be very helpful. There's clearly going to be a lot of interest in these. I know Lisa, I don't believe, can make all three of them, so people might get tired of hearing me. If anyone else feels that they would like to add some value to these, apart from being simply available to attend and support, I mean, clearly we'd expect as many of the members and participants to be available, in addition to being joined from others. Any other comments or points about the structure, organization, and nature of the webinar? We'll clearly make this announcement as widely as possible, but a key function of members of the group, and indeed anyone participating, should be to communicate out both the outcomes and the feedback, and of course the existence of the webinars. Lisa, go ahead.
Thank you, Jonathan. I agree that we will be doing the webinars, and as is written on the chat, I think it's very important that the leads are there too, because it would be very nice to have support for the specific RFPs from the coordinators. And if we stick with the three dates, I'll be able to join all three of them. Thank you.
Wonderful, Lisa. Thanks. I look forward to working with you on those, of course. Good. We should try and then move on, I suppose, to capturing the key items that come out of that. I noticed that there was some question around deadlines. Clearly, we have agreed that we will try and take both input on detail of the proposal as well as questions for public comment by around midday UTC on Saturday to give us time to then spend the next further 24 to 48 hours refining the document for final publication on Monday. I wonder, in terms of capturing the action items, I think that really what I'd hope we'd do is take pull those out of the notes from the meeting today. Is there anything that hasn't been captured or discussed that anyone would like to see specifically take place in the form of actions arising from today's meeting? I mean, comprehensive notes you would have seen forming in the right-hand notes area, and so I think we'll pull a series of actions out of that and present those as a form of action-related minutes coming out of the meeting. I know there's some healthy ongoing discussion about this key issue of delineation of responsibility and capability in the chat, which is useful between particularly the PRT and the CSC. Good. Well, that feels like we've done what we can and should not take much more time at holding those of you who are going to celebrate Thanksgiving away from that, and those of you who have other items in your day to get on with. I guess the one thing in my mind is that anyone who is involved with a chartering group, and anyone who's aware that, just to flag the downstream timeline of this, and it's something which we as co-chairs will need to do, but awareness of the fact that this is coming along and will ultimately need to be scheduled in for approval by the supporting and other chartering organizations. So we need to be aware of what's coming down the track as well. All right. Let me just pause for one final minute to see if anyone else has anything under AOB that I have either covered insufficiently or not covered at all. Great. Thank you all very much. Look forward to ongoing constructive engagement in the email stream, and wishing you a good day in your various parts of the world. Thanks again.